Okay, I'd like to welcome everyone to the next in our series of Shurim about Kashrus issues. Last week we began the topic of Tfilas Kelim, and we discussed where the mitzvah of Tfilas Kelim comes from. It comes from the Torah. Unlike some of the things we were discussing in the past, which were Dirabonans, this mitzvah of Tfilas Kelim, again according to the Mishnah Berurah, even today, is a mitzvah from the Torah under certain circumstances. So we saw that the mitzvah Tfilas Kelim is in the Torah from one word, v'taher, and that word v'taher is there in the middle of the discussion after the war in Midyan, the discussion about how are we machshir, hechshir kelim, which will be in Meretz Hashem B'Li, the next topic. And that is when the Torah discusses, they brought back vessels from the war in Midyan, and they were not kosher. So how do you make them kosher? So the answer is, Elazar HaKohen tells the army how to do that in Meretz Hashem. As I mentioned before, we will discuss that in the next topic. But all of a sudden, in the middle of that discussion, is the word that we learn now, the tahir, that you have to bring any vessels to a mikvah. And now the question is, what is it doing there? Why is the mitzvah Tfilas Kelim there together, interwoven with the mitzvah of, as we call it, Hakshir Kelim, making Kelim kosher that were treif? So we were discussing that last time, and we learned that the idea is because there are connections between Tfilas Kelim and Hakshir Kelim. One is that the Torah only obligates things which wasn't necessarily in this order, that came into direct contact with food. If we're talking about Hakshir Kelim, something that you want to make kosher that was treif, that means it was treif. How did it become treif? It became into contact, and we'll discuss this as we go through various things. We talked about this also with Milchuk and Fleishik. Something that came into direct contact with non-kosher food, if you have a fork or a knife or some type of kli, and it came into contact with some non-kosher food, under certain circumstances, remember heat, all that type of stuff. So then, that vessel is now not kosher. Now we have to make it kosher. What does that mean? So that means it came into direct contact with non-kosher food. This fork skewered a piece of Farmer John ham. Let's say hot Farmer John ham. So now, as we'll discuss later in Hakshir Kelim, now that kli, and we'll discuss why, is treif. So why? It came into contact with non-kosher food. Now again, we'll discuss that a little more deeply when we get to the next topic. It's not just some magical thing, but we'll discuss it more at length in Meretz Hashem when we get to the next topic. And then a lot of the things we're discussing now, and that we discussed in a lot of the topics, especially milk and conflation, will all gel together in Meretz Hashem. So anything that comes into direct contact with food, that has to be tovel. Let's say you have a vessel that does not come into direct contact with food. Let's say, like the crock of a crock pot, not the pot, but the heating part. So you have to total that? Answer is no. It does not come into direct contact with food. That's connection number one. Connection number two is, and this is what we ended up with last time, I think, and that is that any material, any vessel that's made out of a material that can be koshered, so that material has to be totaled. So we saw when we learned the Pesukim last time. So what Elazar HaKohen discusses is metallic materials. Gold, silver, iron, brass, copper, tin, lead. All those things are metal. Those things can be koshered. Again, we'll discuss that later. So those things that can be koshered have to be toveled. So if you have a metal fork or knife or spoon, so that has to be toveled before you use it. Even if it's not, again, I want to emphasize this again, even if it's not treif, you buy something and it's brand new, so it's not treif, you still have to tovel it. It's a separate, independent mitzvah. Tfilas Kelim is a separate, independent mitzvah. So therefore, even if something's not treif, don't get confused. Well, I don't think I have to tovel something that's treif. No, it's a separate, independent mitzvah, but we do learn lessons out of the juxtaposition of Hakshir Kelim with Tfilas Kelim. So therefore, connection number two is anything that can be koshered has to be toveled. Metal can be koshered, has to be toveled. As opposed to and this is what we ended up with last time, things that are cheres, things that are ceramic, china, porcelain, enamel, any of those things that we call cheres, so that those things cannot be kashered, as we'll discuss. So those do not have to be toveled. Side issue is the glaze. That's the whole issue, because the glaze is made out of usually a glass-like material. So is that considered significant or insignificant? If it's considered insignificant, so the main thing is ceramic, so then according to those opinions that say that, so then you do not have to toble china. You would not have to toble china. The only reason why you would have to toble china would be if the glass glaze is considered significant, glass has to be tobled. But that brings us to glass. So what do we have? We have two ends of the spectrum right now. Metal can be koshered, has to be tobled, no question. Cheres does not have to be, cannot be koshered, we'll discuss that, does not have to be tobled, leaving the glaze aside. So how about glass, or things that are like glass? Answer is, glass has to be tobled, midrabanan. Midrabanan, that's going to be important for later. And that's what I think we ended up with. One last thing. The third connection is, and these are the three connections, is that ownership by a non-Jew. Something that was owned at some point by a non-Jew, you might have bought it from a Jew, but Yasul got it from Juan. Assuming Juan is not a convert, right? All right, he bought it from Juan, or he bought it from some Chinese name is probably more likely. And so again, so since at one point it was owned by a non-Jew, so then that article has to be tobled. If you go to Mei Sharim or Gula and buy something directly from someone who manufactured it, and that guy is a Jew, could be anywhere really, but we're using that as an example. So again, if you bought directly from the manufacturer, the manufacturer is a Jew, even if he's a Machal Shabbos. But if he's a Jew, so then you don't have to toble the thing. Now again, as I mentioned last time, it's a little tricky because it could be you bought something in Israel, but really it was manufactured in who knows where, in China most likely. Not most likely, but whatever. So then, again, it's not so simple. But you have, if there is such a situation, that let's say you go to a Judaica store and they're Jewish, and they got it from the manufacturer, let's say a Becher or something, and that those people were Jewish, hypothetically, even though that's not necessarily true, because silver things are made in Italy and made in all other places. But again, leaving the Kittel story aside, so then you would not have to toll the object. You could use it straight. Okay. So what do we got so far? So now we really have a pretty complete picture, sort of, and that is that we know what we have to toll. We have to tovel any utensil which came into direct contact, which does come into direct contact with food, made out of certain materials that was owned by a guy. Okay? And that's true. And that's what we have to tovel. There's just one other consideration which most people don't know. And that is the issue of whether something is a clay suda or a kli suda, depending on what you want to call it. Clay suda means a vessel that's used in a suda, in a meal. Well, what does that mean? So there are many poskim that hold that all those things I just mentioned, you have to tovel. But if you have an article, a utensil, that is not a clay suda, then you would tovel it, but without a bracha. Tovel, but without a bracha. So let's define, or try to define, it's not so simple, what exactly is a clay suda? So again, based upon the three questions which we'll mention now, we'll determine whether something is a clay suda. If it is a clay suda, so then you tovel it with a bracha. Okay? Everybody got that? Okay, so these are the three questions that we ask when we determine whether something is a clay suda. Number one is the food ready to eat after this kli is used? That's one question. Is the food ready? Now, it could be ready right after the kli is used. So, for example, a pot. The pot would be considered a clay suda because, let's say, the soup. You make the soup is ready to eat after you use that kli. So now, again, it's a pot. It's made out of metal. Let's say you bought it from a non-Jewish source. comes in direct contact with food. So, but that's just the first question. Next question is, is the kli you serve an important function? So, for example, a shechita knife. I like that for an example. Right? And the knife that the shochet uses to slaughter the animal. So that's an important function. But based upon question number one, the food's, well, it's not so simple, but the food is basically not ready to eat after it's used. Believe it or not, that's not so simple. But let's still leave that for the time being. Question number three is the kli usually used for consumption? That would be number three. Now, we don't solely go by these three questions. Sometimes we go by a majority. So let's say used for consumption. So let's say you have a canister that you use for storage. Right? Now, again, this is a bad example. But let's say a Rubbermaid container that you store your sugar in. Okay, now it comes in direct contact with food. Let's say you buy from a guy. You usually don't use it for consumption. Now see, with Rubbermaid it's a little different because the plastic usually is a material that we don't total. So let's say you had a metal canister. Right, yeah, right. That would be the example. So in that case, again, you would total it if it's metal, but maybe without a bracha. Because I don't know if that would be considered an important purpose, maybe. Again, is it used for consumption? Usually not. So again, in that case, you'd probably say tovel it but without a bracha, if it's a metal canister. But those are the, so now basically, based upon that, what would you tovel with a bracha? Forks, knives, glasses, right? Even though glass, and I think I mentioned this last time, glass is a dirabbanan, but still you make a bracha. We always make, like I mentioned last time, we make brachas over Dirabbanans all the time, right? Chanukah is a Dirabbanan, Purim is a Dirabbanan. Make brachas on those things. So again, just because something is a Dirabbanan doesn't mean you would not make a bracha on it. So again, what would you tovel with a bracha? Forks, knives, pots, glasses, things like that. If you get something a little more perverse, like maybe like we mentioned last time, the grates of a toaster oven. Mm-hmm. Oh, the metal. I don't know if you consider that a clay suit or not. You know, we could argue about that. A rolling pin. Again, if you had, I don't know if they make them. Well, let's say hypothetically, a metal rolling pin. Mm-hmm. Some, they do?
Stainless steel.
Okay.
The meat grinder. Okay. Also, you don't need to
talk. Meat grinder, probably not. Right. You can toggle it.
Yeah.
But now with... food processor blades.
Right.
Probably total without a bra.
Yeah.
Yeah, we could go endless. So let's not. Okay, good. So that really gives you a more concise idea of what we total and what we don't. Now, a very important halakha which most people don't know is you're not allowed to use a kli even once. This is clear in halakha. You're not allowed to use a kli even once unless, if it needs tefillah. Now, somehow, somewhere, people got the assumption that you can use a kli once without tefillah, and then if you use once, it's okay. It's better to tovel it right away, but if you didn't, you can use it once and... Now, a lot of poskim question, like, where did that come from? Because nobody knows where that came from. I have a theory. I have a theory. And I do emphasize this is my own, and it is a theory. It could be 100% wrong. And it gets us into another area, believe it or not. And that is disposable articles. Now, again... this is a disposable society. We dispose of everything that other societies would maybe not even know that exists. We get rid of, including people, unfortunately. But that's a different issue. Now, so obviously we have disposable kalim, pans, forks, right? Really big thing, found in Costco about a year ago, but now you see them all over the place. You have plastic forks that look like metal. They really look like metal. And you could fool people very easily to thinking that it's really metal and it's really 100% plastic, but, you know, until they lift it. So the question for us, obviously, is you have a disposable aluminum pan. Now, again, we discussed before whether you have to tovel something aluminum altogether. There's a difference of opinion. Again, we discussed when last week when we're talking about materials. So, again, as we go on in history, so we have all these new materials. So we always get arguments whether do you have to tovel them, do you not. We touched on this last week about Teflon and Corel and Corningware and Silverstone and Duralex and Pyrex, thank you, and all the other Rexes, and all those type of things. So obviously, aluminum is a relatively new material. So the question is, do you have to tovel an aluminum or not? So let's go according to those posts and say yes, because it's like a metal. Okay, again, we're going to leave that issue of whether aluminum has to be tovel or not. Let's say yes. So the question is, we got an aluminum foil pan. So the question is, can I use it without being tovel it? It comes in direct contact with food I bought from a guy. It's metal, let's say. So do I have to tovel it? So generally it's accepted that no, you don't have to tovel it. Why? Answer is because many poskim say that something, a kli, that you're going to use once and throw away is not a kli. That's not a vessel, because I'm going to throw it out. So that's not considered a kli. Okay, so let's accept that, which is generally accepted. Now, but let's take it a little further. Let's say you are going to use that disposable pan more than once. So then what? Do you have to tovel it? Because you said the reason why you don't tovel is it's not kli. So how about if I'm going to use it 2, 3, 4 times? Some people do this. They wash them and they use them again. So then you have to tovel it. You get into a big machlokas. Some, believe it or not, say, yes, you do have to tovel it. And you have to tovel it even before the first time. Mm-hmm. Now, see, this is where I think the first time with a fork got messed up. In other words, because people say, I mean, we generally, that if you have an aluminum pan, and you use only once, you don't have to tovel it. So I think there was somehow a quantum leap there that if you have a fork, a real McCoy fork, if there is such a comment, I don't know, O'Neill, what's the name of the? Whatever the company that makes these things, the fork, huh? Oneida. Fork, so if I use it once, so it's not a kli yet. Now that's a wrong Svara, as we say, because if it's an Oneida fork, it's a kli no matter what you do. I don't care who you are, right? That's a kli, right? The question is, by aluminum, which it says on it, disposable. So is that a kli? Now, believe it or not, this comes up in other areas of halacha also, and that is, let's say, Kiddush on Shabbos could use a non-becher. Let's say you use a paper cup, or a styrofoam cup. So believe it or not, many poskim say you cannot, because you need a kli, you need a vessel in order to make kiddush. So based upon what we just said, if you're going to toss it, that's not a kli. Okay? You see, this flies off into different areas of halakha, believe it or not. I mean, I'm sure you do believe it. So again, this is my theory where the one usage idea came from. I could use a disposable pan once, and not tovel it, so I can use a fork once without toveling it. Now again, halakhically in rationale, that's not true. Those are not connected. So now again, getting back to disposable kalim, so we have a difference of opinion. Some say that if you're going to use it more than once, you have to tovel it, because that's a kli. Others say that no, you don't have to tovel it at all. Why? I mean, it's metal, it comes into our time, all those things we mentioned before. Why should you not have to tovel it? Answer is, there's an interesting svara, as we say. And that is, this is a disposable kli, meaning it's made to be thrown out. It's made to be thrown out. So if I, me, or somebody, anybody here, decides to keep it and use it for a more, quote-unquote, permanent fashion, so now listen to this. So now Mr. Schwartz or Mrs. Schwartz, who now is using it more than once, it's considered like Mrs. Schwartz made this vessel. It's like they made this vessel. So therefore, what is it? The Jew made the vessel. Therefore, it doesn't need tefillah. Everybody got that? I want to say who, but one very big posek told me, a big, very big Talmud Chacham, told me the following story that he was in Russia in the old days. And for whatever reason, he got stuck in Russia, which a lot of people did. But and he thought he'd leave before Shabbos, but it was Wednesday, and he realized, Mrs. Kronbach will relate to this, from the old country, that he wasn't going to get out like he thought he would. He'd have to stay. So, see, this is how a big Talmud Chacham thinks. So it was Wednesday, and he realized, I'm going to be here for Shabbos. I need to make Kiddush. There's not so much it was hard to get kedem in those days in Moscow. So, right? So I witnessed if you didn't trust me. So this is the way a Talmud Chacham thinks. So he figured, no problem, I'll make my own wine. Now see, this is the way he thinks on Wednesday, because after 3 days, grape juice is considered wine. So therefore, Wednesday he's thinking already, I have to make wine. No problem. So he goes and buys some grapes, clusters of grapes. And for an American, that wasn't hard to find. And he was to squash the grapes and make wine. Then leave it for 3 days. Then Friday night, it's wine, halakhically. So good, no problem. So believe it or not, that's not the problem. The problem was he needed a vessel to make he needed a pot to make the wine in. Oh, no problem. You go down to wherever in Russia. And like I said, maybe the regular person can't get it, but American can. So again, I'll buy a pot. Okay, that's not such a big problem. Again, for an American. but then he had to tovel it. Right? There's the problem. Where are you going to tovel it? Where are you going to tovel it? Okay. So he would find a river. Again, we'll get to this. Not every natural body of water. This is also a mistake people make. But we'll get talk about this later. I don't know today, but whatever. He would find a body of water that he could use to tovel the kli. There's the problem. Because he was told he was being followed, which was his assumption. He told us interesting the story of how he spoke to the refuseniks. I think I mentioned this to him. That they had, you know, remember when you were little kids before everybody was text messaging, kids do that now. Right, cell phones, everything. So, but there used to be a toy that kids used to like to play with, which is a slate, and it had a film on it, and you wrote on it, or you drew a picture, and then you lifted it up, and it disappeared. Right, remember that? Not an Etch-a-Sketch, but I don't...
Magic Eraser,
but whatever it is. So refuseniks evidently had that, and they wrote to each other. And then you lift it up, so then the KGB wouldn't know what you're writing, and there's no evidence. So he was told that he couldn't total something, because if he goes and total something, he'll be arrested. So now that's the problem. The problem is, how do I get a pot to make the wine? That was the problem. So what did he do? He said, a big pot of vegetables, of canned vegetables. He didn't need the canned vegetables, he needed the can. So, and he opened it up, and I don't know what he did with the canned vegetables. And then he relied upon these opinions that said, this is, right, a can. Normally, what do? You empty the stuff and then you throw out the can. So what did he do? He kept the can to use it to make his wine in, and he relied upon those opinions, which many people do. It's not a bizarre opinion. That's considered as if I made the kli. I made the pot. And now, Rabbi so-and-so made the pot. Now it's not obligated in tefillas kelim, and he made his wine. Right? So that's the other opinion by disposal. So some say, and again, this is a big machlokas, that even a disposable whatever would not ever be chayv in tefilas kelim. Why? Because the Jew made it into a kli. Now you see, this comes up in other areas also. Let me give you an example. We got somebody on one of those Yom Tovim, there's usually Pesach or Sukkot, or usually Pesach. There's all these things on the market which you normally can't get. Unusual items. So there was these cherries that were under Hashgacha that came from some country, I don't know where. And so, again, what was interesting is not only the product, but also it came in a glass container, which, glass containers are very unusual today. Nothing's glass anymore. So, for whatever reason, my wife decided to keep that glass thing to make tea scents in, to leave on the block on Shabbos. Okay? That didn't last long. It broke, so then we just got a ceramic teapot that we used for the tea scents. But be that as it may. So the question is, would that tea scents jar be obligated to Tefilas Kelim? Right? That would be the question. So this would be the answer, that usually it's just something that's tossed, right? You take out the cherries and then you throw it away. Okay, you put in the blue bin, recycle, fine. But again, according to many poskim, it would not be obligated in Tefilas Kelim if it's not, because why? The Jew is making it into a kli by the means of using it as something more permanent. So that's the issue. Now, if you go this way, you have to realize, if you go the other way, if you say you do want to tovo your disposable aluminum thingy, as we call it, pan or whatever it is, you should realize that I would tell you to tovo it without a bracha. Because again, there are posts going to say you don't have to tovo it all together. So you don't have to tovo it all together. But again, we'll get to this issue a little later when we talk about this.
If you go that route, and you were...
Which way?
If you were to tovel, you have to tovel. Mm-hmm. So now it's Erev Yontif, and you've torn up aluminum foil, and you know how we all reuse aluminum foil?
Right, we're not talking about aluminum foil, because aluminum foil is not a kli.
Even if you then wrap it around something?
Right, that's not a kli. Okay. We're talking about an aluminum... pan.
Okay, but that pan.
Aluminum,
that,
whatever.
On Yom Tov, as you're putting things away, you take the pan.
Right, so aluminum foil is not a kli. It's okay. Just whatever it is.
Okay. The question is also.
Mr. Cohen was patiently waiting.
It raised other issues too, but Yorkside candles used to make very good.
Right. The Meshulachim used to use them as teacups. Right, so that would be the same thing. Assuming that the Yahrzeit candle company is not Jewish, which a lot of them, Menorah or whatever they are.
They're all jelly jars.
Right. I don't know what you do with the pickle smell, but okay, let's leave that aside. That's a separate issue. Okay. Now, maybe we'll touch on it later, but something repaired and things like that. We'll get to it in Meretz Hashem later, and electric things. Okay, we'll get to those questions a little later. Now, what I want to touch on next is how do you tovel something? How do you actually tovel something? Okay. Now, it's cold. Mr. Cohen will see if he could, what he could do. Okay, now, how do you tovel something? Let's talk about that. So the halacha is that the water has to, well, before we get there. Yeah. Before we talk about that, we're about to talk about the water. First, you have to, as I mentioned before, you have to find a body of water that you could tovel something in. That's not so simple. Okay, here in Anshem, this maybe is a little more simple. It's called our backyard, where we have Baruch Hashem, it's Kelim Mikvah. But sometimes it's not so simple. Now, for whatever reason, some people are under the assumption you could tovel a kli in almost anything. That is incorrect. You have to have a body of water which could be used for a person to tovel in. In other words, if it was to be kosher for a person who has to, not custom, but has to go to the mikvah, woman, for example, so then that vest, that thing could be used for tefillah stand. If it can't be used halakhically for a woman to go use for her, so then it can't be used for tefillah kelim. Now again, we're not talking about whether it's practical for a human being to use it. Like, for example, in the backyard, I don't know if it's that practical because it's above ground. But again, the body of water would be kosher hypothetically for tefillah of a person. So again, I'm not going to teach you how to make a mikvah because that is very complicated. But we'll just touch upon a few basic, very basic, extremely basic ideas. First of all, you have to have a certain type of water. As we all know, the water that you have cannot be mayim shuavim. Mayim shuavim. Shuav, or shoev rather. Probably know the capital team. Shatem mayim besoson. You should draw water in happiness, with happiness, referring to the nisoch hamayim and the sukkas. But shuavim means drawn, not like to draw a picture, but rather to draw with a vessel, meaning that the water that we use to tovel cannot be water that was drawn, meaning it can't be water that went through any kli at any point. If water came into a kli, came into a vessel, so then that water is not good for a mikvah. Not good for a mikvah. So somebody told me a story recently that when his family was becoming frum, so one of the first things his mother learned was tefillas kelim. So all of a sudden, his father came home. They weren't living in Los Angeles, and all their dishes are in the bathtub. So the father had some interesting words to the wife about like what was going on. But we can't use tap water. The reason why we can't use tap water is, as we know, water that comes out of a tap is filtered, and there's a lot of things that go through, maybe not in New York where all the bugs are in it, but whatever. But even in New York, they just do not a good job of it. But the question is, what is considered halakhically a kli? Now, obviously, a cup is a kli. Other things, anything that has a receptacle is considered a kli. So now, if at somewhere from the High Sierra, from the Colorado River till our tap, the water that comes out of your tap went through a kli, which could be a filter, depending on how the filter is made, so then that water is invalid for tefillah. So now the problem is, if somebody did a tremendous amount of investigation, maybe they could find that all the water coming from the Colorado River never went through a halacha kli. But that would be very difficult to ascertain. So therefore, we assume that any water that's tap water is not good for tefillah. That's the way. Now, the trick is to gather water somehow so that it never went through a kli. So how do we do that? So there's various ways we could do it. The basic way to do it is use rainwater. The simple way to do it is to have a receptacle and rain falls into it. So let's use a simple explanation. Let's say if you had a pool and you drained the pool completely, a dry pool, and a few days ago it rained pretty hard. So then now there's rainwater in there. So can you use that as a mikvah? Answer is yes. You could. Now let's go on to the second thing. And the second thing is not only the type of water, you have to have a certain amount of water. You have to have what we call 40 saw. saw as a liquid measurement of water, of non-mayim shuvim water. How much is 40 saw? Approximately 191 gallons. Let's make it 200 just to make it round it off. Approximately 200 gallons. So you have to have 200 gallons of non-mayim shuvim water. So again, that's not such a big deal, especially with the rains we had a few days ago. So again, if you drain the pool completely, it's a dry pool, and it rained, you could very easily get 200 gallons fairly quickly. Fairly quickly. Is that a good mikvah? Yes. Is it practical? No. Very simple reason why. Because, as anybody knows, that water will get dirty and gunky and get algae and all sorts of things on it very quickly. So you have to chlorinate it. Right? We had that problem. That's why there's a big sign by the Kalem Mikvah. There's chlorine in there because it... And somebody, one day a few years ago, I got a box in the mail, and it was somebody's sweater. And it was chlorinated. And she said that she was toveling something, and it splashed, and it ruined her sweater, and she wanted the shul to pay for her sweater. You have no idea what I put over. So, I believe it or not, we asked the Shaila, and the postal guy said, definitely not. And then there's... But we did put up a sign because of that. There's a big sign, as you know. So that's one of the reasons why. So in a pool, you could do that, but the only problem is after a short time, it's not going to be too practical. So again, so that's basically, so what do we do? So if you just had to go straight into the reservoir, that's how you could do it. And you could do it that way. Now, there's other technicalities in that is you have to make sure there's no seepage. Because if the water flows, so then the mikvah is invalid. We had this problem, believe it or not, in the backyard a few years ago, in a way that I don't want to get into. That's difficult to with our time constraints. But Baruch Hashem, it's not a problem now. But it was a little challenge a number of years ago. But again, if the water flows, it's a problem. So now you understand that we have a problem if you have rainwater, it has to be stationary, it has to be in one place. That's what we call a mikvah. It comes from the pasuk in Bereishis. Ulmikveh hamayim karayamim. Mikveh hamayim means the gathering of waters. So if you have rainwater, it has to be stationary. If it flows, and again, flow can mean a leak, so then the mikvah is no good. This is a mikvah rabbi's nightmare. That's why you have to be very careful how you pour the cement, and there's a way to pour the cement and build a mikvah, because if it leaks, there's big problems. So now this brings up why you can't use just anything. Like, people assume that if it's a natural body of water, you could use it. So people use rivers. Now, just again, I don't want to get into it too much, but a lot of times rivers are major problems. Because we know many rivers, they're stronger around spring, early summer, than they are in the middle of the summer or even this time of year. And the reason is because these rivers, I think even the Rio Grande or many of them, any river, is stronger or weaker depending on the runoff, meaning that there's snow, and the snow melts, and then it flows into the river. So what is that snow that melted? It's rain. Rainwater that's melted, and now, so you have rainwater in the river, and if the river is a lot of rainwater, and the river, by definition, is flowing, so that's not a kosher mikvah. It's a big problem. So it's very complicated what you can use and what you can't. So if you have a lake, again, so usually a lake was from a natural aquifer, usually, so then you could use that. You can use that. So again, you just have to be aware. That's the basic idea of a mikvah, where it gets a little more complicated than that. Yes.
Ocean
usually you can use. Yeah.
But they're still flowing.
Right, but that's still considered okay. It's not considered like a river. Ocean is usually okay for other reasons also. Now, just very quickly, I wanted to explain to you that So basically now if you have a receptacle and rainwater got into it without going through a kli, that's a kosher mikvah, and that's the way we build a mikvah. Well, the thing is, you have to realize there's a trick to it, and you might notice it in the backyard. And that is, if there's two ways to basically build a mikvah. One way, this is above ground. See, this is the mikvah and this is the lid. So one way is, you get your 40 saw of rainwater, and that's a kosher mikvah. The halacha is that once you have the 40 saw, you can add as much non-kosher water, you can add as much maim shuvim to this as you want, and it's still okay. So then what do I do, or not I, you add that much tap. And all of this, the entire mixture is considered kosher water. You have to have the mikvah water first. That's why if you notice, when I was talking about the pool, I said you drain out the pool completely. So this is a legitimate way, and you maybe will, next time you use a kelim mikvah, you'll see some kelim mikvahs are like this. It's perfectly okay. It's called zriya. Zriya, like the word zera. You seed it. You have the seed, and it grows. Now, you can keep on doing this. People use the mikvah, and the water goes down. You can add more tap water. Right? Nothing wrong with that. Except for one opinion, according to Rambam. But again, some people make kelim mikvah, or even people mikvah this way. Okay? This is way number one. There's nothing wrong with it. That's the way some people make a mikvah. There's another way to make a mikvah. That is, now I'm looking from above. I'm looking bird's eye now, as opposed to this one. That I have my 40 saw of rainwater. Right? But remember what I said before? If the tap water, the mayim shuvim, comes into contact with the kosher water, the non-kosher water becomes kosher. It changes over. So how about this? We'll make an area over here which is full of tap water, but I have a pipe, a connector in between the two. Now, how big does that have to be? I don't want to get into it. I don't want to get into that right now. But now these two touch. Or is it what we call in halacha? Hashaka. Comes from a word neshika. They kiss. These two connect. Right? Here's the kosher water, here's the tap water. Could be this is a lot of water. More than this. But once they touch through this pipe, then this becomes kosher water. If you've been back in the backyard, this is what we do. This is what we do. Now you see, you have to realize these two ways save us a lot of heartache, because if you have to actually tovel in the rainwater, which could, there's nothing wrong with that. The only problem is a practical problem. In areas like California or Arizona or other places when there doesn't rain that much, so then your mikvah is going to be limited because people are going to use it, and then there's displacement of water, then you run out of water. So because of this halacha, which everybody accepts, we can make a mikvah this way and constantly reseed it. Not reseed, go down, but rather re-S-E-E-D, make it bigger. Right? Now the only problem with this way, the first way, is Zriya, the only problem with that is, like I said before, practically you are losing some of the original water, so, but according to most poskim, that's not a problem. The other problem is, after a little while, it's going to get gunky. Right? Even though you're putting fresh water into it, but still, practically, after a little while, it's going to get gunky. That's going to happen. This way, the second way, hashaka, it's less of a problem. Now see, you have to realize, in the backyard now, a lot of people think they're toveling their fork or knife in the rainwater. Not true. They're toveling it in converted tap water. Right? It's perfectly legitimate. In fact, this is the way we usually make mikvahs. Usually. I'll explain that in a second. So, and this is perfectly okay. And this way, we save the rainwater, and every once in a while, Mr. Sarto and Mr. Jacobs go in the back, usually on a Sunday, and then we have a sump pump. We suck out. Before we do that, we have a cap in the office. We put on the cap, seal off the rainwater. Then we have a sump pump, or Mr. Jacobs, you just use a siphon, and siphon out all the dirty rainwater, tap water, which was used by a lot of people. And we suck it all out. Mr. Sarto, with tremendous courage, jumps in. There, it's pretty much empty, but not completely. We have a wet vac that sucks out the rest of it. He disinfects it with Ajax and all the other things. They wash it out, and they take out all the stuff that some people dropped on the bottom, which is also there, including rings and all sorts of things. And then what do? They fill it up again with tap water. They run, you know, on the side of the shul, there's a faucet. And they run, you probably noticed they have hoses. They run all the way over there. They fill it up with tap water, put chlorine in. Then when it's up to the desired height, then they open up the tap. They open up the plug. They touch, kosher water. Okay.
But the rainwater isn't staying on that side. It's
mixing to one degree or another.
So isn't it still mixing in a similar?
But not as not like this. No, you're not taking it not like that. It's just simple physics because this is full and this is full, so there is exchange, but not that much practically. Now, again, I don't want to get into it that much because we're getting a little late, but you have to realize this is the way we make people mikvahs too. Now, you have to realize what we could do is more than that. Make a bunch of these things.
Right?
And each one's called a base tefillah. And each one of these could be used for tefillah. Right? But we're just tentacling off, what's the word I'm looking at? We're spiraling off the 40 saw. That's what we do. And then what do you do if you have a big people mikvah, so then Baruch Hashem today, everything's mechanical. That could be every day. During the day when people aren't using it. So there's pipes on the side, on the wall. Now you might notice next time you use a people mikvah, there's usually a hole in the wall somewhere. And that hole in the wall is connecting to where the rainwater is behind the wall. Right? You might also notice along the walls, there are pipes. It depends on how they do it. One is an intake, one is a suction. And what they'll do is they put the plug in, right, during the day, suck out all the water. Sometimes they just flip a switch, they suck out all the water. Then they have somebody go in and disinfect it, right? Doesn't take that long. Well, I've never done it, but. And then when that's done, push a button, new water comes in, open up the connection, voila, clean water, right? You could do this for all these. Well, it could be, you know, who knows how many. And that's how we make people mikvah, with conservation of the precious rainwater. That's Mr. Cohen.
Is the pure water chamber filled to the top completely full?
It could be, but it doesn't have to be. There's a technical, I don't want to get into that right now. Yeah, there's a tech. I don't want to get into it. Okay, so now, yeah.
Kaylee mikvah, you never empty the 40 stuff? Like right now, you have new rainwater.
We haven't done it recently because there's no need for it.
Okay.
One of these days, years ago, a number of years ago when I was in Chicago visiting my in-laws, so it was a typical Chicago night when it was pouring. I mean, absolutely, it was from the Midwest. I mean, it was coming down like worse than it was like unbelievable. So it was a very, very late night, 10, 11, 12 o'clock at night, and there was the phone at my in-law's house rang. kind of unusual. So they answered the phone. It was Rabbi Furst, the Dayan in Chicago, and he was calling me. He knew I was in town. He was calling me because he's the Rav of the mikveh in Chicago, and he said it was coming down. He said they were going to change the rainwater. So he wanted to know if I wanted to come down and watch them change the rainwater. And I appreciated the offer, but, you know, like... So, see, yeah, it's... I like to know, it's very scary. Usually, if you're a Rav of a mikveh, you don't want to change the water that much because... And it did happen to a Kalim mikveh locally a number of years ago that... They said it was going to rain. We all know the weather. So there's 100% chance it's going to rain. And it's going to be a gully washer. And they predicted rain. So they emptied out their Kalim Mikvah. And it didn't rain. And it didn't rain for the rest of the year. It didn't rain for the rest of the year. And they had all these shilas. Like, could it use snow? Could it not use snow? They called it. It was all... From what I understand, Anshei Emes had a role in that because they called a posuk in Eretz Yisrael and he said, well, how far is the other Kalim Mikvah? Is there a Kalim? And they said, well, it's on the other side of town. And then he said, well, how far is that? They said about 6 miles. How long does it take to get there? 10-15 minutes. So he said, that's not that far. Right? But anyway, so, you know, you never know. You know, you have these paranoid fears. So the only thing you could do is, like, when it's actually raining, it's pouring, to get people to come out, like the story I said with Rabbi Furst, and suck out the water, and you know. So it's easier to do with a people mikveh because that water is indoors. But, like, I don't know if I have the guts to ask Rob Jacobs and Mark Sarto and all those guys to come down in a pouring rain. So the only thing we could do is, like, again, if they say it's going to really pour, to suck out the water and roll the dice. But after what happened with this other chemical, I'm loath to do that. Okay. Maybe we'll just do a little bit more. So, and then we'll continue this Birnas Hashem next time. Okay, so now I got my body of water, whatever it may be. So now you have to be aware that when just like by a person, the entire surface area of the kli has to come in contact with the water. The entire surface area. Let's say this is a kli, this is a fork or whatever it is. So this has to be entirely, every area externally, if it's a pot, internally also, has to come into contact with the water. And this brings up the issue of what we call a chatzitza. I'm running out of room here. A chatzitza. A chatzitza is an impediment. Impediment. Now, there could be things that prevent the water from touching even part of this, of the surface of this kli. So we're all familiar with what these things are. Stickers, made in China, right? Could be dirt. Could be rust. It could be any of those things. So we have to get rid of those things before you use the Kalim Mikvah. And don't get me started on this. People leave stickers and trash and all these type of things in the backyard or on the mikvah itself. We'll leave that. Now, just by the way, acetone nail polish remover is good to get rid of that stuff. But again, you should try to think in advance before you come to make sure you get rid of these things, not doing the job. Next week, what we'll talk about is that there's another type of chatzitza, and that is the human being themselves. And that is just very quickly, and we'll we'll talk about this next time, and that is that when we total something, so, you know, you don't want to drop it. So a lot of times people hold on very tightly, and they're scared to lose this. So they take this, and they make a bracha, let's say, in certain circumstances, and they dip it into the mikvah, and they take out, and they say, it's tovel. It's not. Because how about the area where my fingers were? Those areas did not get tovel. And the halacha is that the entire kli, this is not true by kashering, but by toveling something, has to be toveled at one time. You can't do halvesies. That's why the kalim mikvah, believe it or not, is big, the area where we tovel it. Because we did have in mind if a caterer uses it. So sometimes they can have very big pots or tureens or things like that. So it has to be big enough that they could total those things in. So getting back to the challenge is if you have something, you might tovel it. So how do you make sure, how do you tovel in a way that you are not the chatzitza, that you are not the impediment in this thing? So Meretz Hashem, we'll talk about that, Belina, next week. Okay?